I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Around this time in 2004, this program began, and so 7 years later, this seventh anniversary show. I marked the program's anniversary last year, and this year I'll do the same. I like doing this retrospective because it's a chance to look back at the previous programs, the guests who've appeared, and an opportunity to listen in on the sort of conversations that have broken out on this website over the years. Summers are less hectic on this website, and the program is rather quiet. I did come back last month on the news of Gary Bannerman's death and did a program remembering Gary, his great broadcasting career, and the man himself with some of his friends and colleagues. But usually the show is dormant over the summer, as there aren't many books to talk about, and people are usually outside and not in front of a computer. After the number of political programs I did this past spring, I left the program in early June and enjoyed the break. However, each year around mid-August, I get a little antsy. I wonder whether I should come back in the fall and continue the program. I'll often go back and listen to some old interviews, and that gets me motivated to continue. As always, when doing this clip show, there are more clips that I'd have wanted included than there's time. Otherwise, this retrospective would take several hours. Even I can't tolerate the sound of my own voice for that long. I hesitated in going back and including some of my favorite interviews, many of which can be found on last year's show. I tried, as had been suggested, to look back at the year that was, and though I tried to focus only on the last 12 months, invariably one went back further. The death last week of Jack Layton does not go unnoticed on this program today. The federal NDP leader appeared on this program twice, in November 2004 and in November 2006. You'll hear from those interviews. You'll also, of course, hear from the many writers and novelists who've appeared over the years. There are a couple of minor themes to the show. One is a view to the interests I have, both silly and serious, which I try to work in from time to time. A serious one is Philippine culture and politics. Charlie Rose likes to talk about French culture and politics, so I've taken the liberty of talking about the Philippines on this program. You'll hear from a number of guests who've given a view onto the country. A silly interest is my fascination with fountain pens. I'll include some clips illustrating that obsession. From time to time, television personalities appear on this program. It's always fun to talk to the people you watch. National and local anchors have appeared over the years. We'll hear from six. All that and much more is to come next on this look back, and of course when the program returns for its eighth year in September. Thanks for listening. Jack Layton's death touched a chord in the Canadian consciousness last week. I'd interviewed Layton twice. He appeared in the early days of this program in November 2004, which was rather neat. I've always thought the appearances on this program so soon after it started by Peter C. Newman, Sheila Copps, and Jack Layton gave the program a sort of credibility it otherwise would not have had. Here's Jack Layton from November 2006. By that time, Paul Martin was gone, and Stephen Harper had become Prime Minister, having won the election in January of that year.
How is Stephen Harper to deal with compared to Paul Martin?
I think both feel this certain sense of entitlement about governing, as though they had the support of the majority of Canadians. Interestingly, neither of them ever did. And I think a little more humility and understanding that maybe working with other parties in a democratic system where you didn't get a majority of votes would be the right thing to do. That would be something beneficial for both of them. They have different personal styles, but in the end, you're sitting down talking to an individual who's been chosen by some Canadians from their riding, and chosen by their party to lead, and so you simply sit down and talk about the issues as you see them. With Mr. Harper, I gave him a copy of a book called The Weathermakers, which your listeners will probably know, written by Tim Flannery, the professor from Australia, that lays out some of these climate change issues. And I said to Mr. Harper, I really think that on behalf of all of our kids, this is the kind of book that we should all read, and then we should take the impacts that are facing the average working person, not only here in Canada but globally, and we should take them to heart and try to do something to change the direction that we're currently headed in, which is obviously unsustainable. And I would have to say that in the case of Mr. Martin, it took a parliamentary crisis for him to react to that. In the case of Mr. Harper, I'm not sure that it was the crisis aspect of it. I don't think he really believed that a non-confidence motion would pass this fall. But he did agree that at least we should explore the possibilities. And so that's what we'll do.
Jack Layton was on the program in November 2006 to promote a memoir he'd just published, talking about his career in politics, both municipally and federally, as well as articulated some of his policies. I asked him about the reaction had to the book thus far, as well as to look towards the future.
Well, I think that people have been very kind. They, of course, that's what they're going to tell me, I guess. But I've simply tried to recount the stories of good ideas being put into practice across the country, and some of my own experiences working with people to get results. And I guess there's an optimistic tone to it. It starts off in part with the message from my father. He always used to tell our kids, you know, don't miss the opportunity to serve if it comes along, and to try and get things done. And so the book is sort of permeated with that kind of optimism. And I'm fortunate to be with a partner in politics and in life, Olivia Chow, who's now a member of Parliament, who was with me on City Council for many years, who has that same optimistic approach. And indeed, our party is always focused not necessarily on power so much as on getting results. I mean, look at Medicare for Canada, brought by the NDP, even though Tommy Douglas was never Prime Minister. And so there's a lot of that sort of history and that sort of engagement that's talked about in the book, and maybe people appreciate a little bit of optimism every now and again.
Do you find, though, with the young people that you talk to, that they are optimistic, that they are drawn to serve in public life, as you were?
More and more I find that's the case, and I've been teaching for, I hate to tell you how many decades, colleges and universities and so on, and I do find a real sense of optimism, but also a sense of urgency amongst young people today. I think they see that the transformations of the environment that are happening so rapidly are going to have an enormous impact on them, and they're very frustrated at how slow our society seems to be willing to respond, even though they know there are many solutions available and that we could get started on them. And that's, I think, very frustrating to young people. And so I'm very enthused by going to colleges and campuses, which I have been doing a lot of, and hundreds of people coming out with this sense of energy. It's really quite exciting to see.
How poignant after last Saturday's state funeral. There's another passing to note. The television personality Ken Caustic died in April of this year. He was on the program in November 2009. I asked him about his partner on television, Mary Jo Eustace.
Some of the interviews that she's done on her own, they ask about you. And I'm sure you're asked about her when people interview you.
Mm-hmm.
Is what we see on TV, the two of you, is that what happens off camera?
Yes, it is. I mean, I spoke to her Saturday evening before I went on the tour, and we had a long chat, and, you know, I think what has happened is we've gone in reverse in maturity level. I mean, we're just not very mature people, and we do have an enormous amount of respect for each other. But, you know, I'm a confident enough person, and she is also, to, you know, to take jabs at each other. And we know that they're just meant in jest. They're not meant in a mean way. And but we, you know, I mean, off camera, we talk about some, you know, pretty interesting things. I said to her on Saturday, I said, you know, Mary Jo, with what we know about each other, we could write a tell-all book, you know, the best of what's for dinner. She even named it, called, you know, dish to dish, you know.
Yeah.
But we get along very well, and I love her kids, and, you know, it's like a marriage that you've had for, you know, 15 years.
Yeah. And then, I mean, if you wrote a tell-all book, you could tell a lot. You were with her through all that Dean and Tory stuff?
Yeah, from day one.
Yeah.
I was offered $75,000 by the Inquirer to spill the beans.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll never forget saying to them, I said, you know, what would motivate me to do this? First of all, you know, I should tell you, I have enough to give you, but what would motivate me? Oh, well, you know, we'll pay you. And I said, so, you know, here her husband just left her and you know, did all this stuff. And then her next best friend is going to betray her? What's in your mind? And you know, she referred to herself as a journalist, and that's where I took issue. I said, you're not calling yourself a journalist, are you?
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, I've gone through it all, and she's gone through all, you know, different things in my life. And, you know, the interesting thing about what we do is you know, it really narrows down your group of friends and the people that you can actually trust and not have, you know, everything get out there and in print.
Well, one of the things that I read about the two of you, and I think she said it, mm-hmm. was that there are a lot of people, I mean, I'm sure when you go across the country, you're recognized for
yes.
the show. Someone said to her that they're oddly enough, both repulsed and attracted by the two of you on television.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think what it is people are always shocked. I mean, if you think about it, we were the first reality television on television in the sense that we talked about our own lives. She you know, she talked about me in great detail. You know, we went through a period of time where we had issues with each other. So, you know, we were dealing with this sudden notoriety, and I think what people are surprised about is that on a cooking show, we talk about the subject matter that we talk about, you know, and I think that's what it is. But that's what people find really interesting about what who we are. I don't find it that interesting because I guess I do that every day and I talk to her every day, but. The general public really does find that whole sense of what are they going to say next or what is she going to do and how is he going to take it? And, you know, I mean, she's a very strong woman. And I'll be honest with you, you know, if I did what she does to me on television, as you know, as a male, I would have been fired years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so she, you know, we have kind of a reversal of the roles and we laugh at that because she is a very strong woman and you know, I'm a very strong man and a lot of what you see as Ken on television is really, you know, in my real life I wouldn't tolerate a lot, you
right.
know, but it's part of entertainment.
5 years ago I interviewed Mike Leonard from NBC News. He had written a book talking about taking his elderly parents across the United States via RV. A portion of that interview was featured on last year's anniversary show. In May of this year, his father, Jack, died. If you've ever seen Mike's reports on the Today Show, you'll know his dad well. Here's Mike Leonard on how his parents were doing that morning in April 2006.
Well, they're doing fine. I mean, they're old. My dad is 89. My mom is now 84. My dad got cancer. He had something. During the trip, he was complaining about his ear. He couldn't hear very well. It ended up being cancer behind his ear, and so they removed it, his left ear, and it was a, you know, difficult operation for a man his age, but he weathered it well, and he's exactly the same person, you know, minus the ears. He's really very, very upbeat. He feels really, I don't know, he's kind of amazed that all of this has happened, and I think part of his amazement is that, and he's a child of Irish immigrants, and they, you know, had a typical difficult life during the Depression, but they're good people, and he said to me the other day when he read it, because I just gave them a chance to read it right before it came out, I didn't want them to be worried about what people would think about some of their outlandish behavior. And my dad was, he said he cried when he read it because now people will know his dad, and I think when he said that, he meant sort of everybody like his dad who work hard, try to make a good life, and then move on, and nobody really knows who they are. So it's kind of like a bow to all the people like that.
Last September, I did a delightful interview with the legendary artist Robert Bateman. It's one of my favorite interviews. Here's a short clip wherein I asked Bateman about what his day is like.
What's your day like? Do you paint all day?
Yes, I start, first thing in the morning after I do the evening dishes. Birgit, my wife, does the cooking, and I do the cleanup and get the kitchen all clean and sweep the floor and everything in the morning while my brain and my body are kind of getting into gear. And then I do a hike or a bike ride around our property. We live, we're lucky, we live here on Salt Spring Island, a bit of acreage, and so I've got all kinds of trails I can go hiking on. And again, just see what's happening in nature and get the blood flowing. And it's usually about 9:30 or 10 o'clock when I get in here, and I've got two full-time assistants, and they've got emails that are coming in or interviews like this one they're setting up or something. And I sit down at my easel, and I can normally paint while I'm talking on the phone, but at this moment I'm staring at a painting, so I'm painting in my head about the things I intend to do to it, but I don't have a paintbrush in my hand. And so then that goes on till lunchtime. We have lunch, and then Birgit and I go for about a 20 to 40 minute hike, have a nap, and then back at the easel, and then in the evening I get on the, at 5:30 I get on the exercise bike and watch the BBC World Service News. And then I have the TV going pretty well all evening while I paint, but I hate commercials. So it would be Knowledge Network here in British Columbia, or we can get TV Ontario because we've got a satellite,
mm-hmm.
or PBS down in Seattle, and watching documentaries and shows of that sort till 10 o'clock, and then go to bed, hopefully read for half an hour or so. And so that's like that 7 days a week, unless I have interruptions.
The writer Camilla Gibb was on the program in October 2010 to talk about her novel, The Beauty of Humanity Movement.
No, I just got the book, say, 2 days ago.
Mm.
So I haven't read the book, but I've read about it. And I can't wait to read it because of Pho. I guess it's pronounced Pho, right?
Yeah, it's pronounced Pho, but we more commonly know it as Pho, so I tend to refer to it as Pho.
Yeah. One of the characters in the book sells Pho out on the streets of Hanoi, right?
Yes, he pushes a sort of a rickety old cart throughout the streets. He's an old man by this point, by the time the book opens. And he's been doing this for, I don't know, something like 30 years, and setting up his stall in a new location every day. And word just travels, people, by word of mouth throughout the old quarter, and people gather. This kind of loyal contingency that's followed him for 30 years gathers for breakfast every morning.
You spent some time in Vietnam, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's quite common there, right? I was in the Philippines, and people selling food off of a cart.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, especially if they don't have a license to operate a business, and still in Vietnam, things are very prescriptive, and you know there must be a license for everything. And in this case, the character's he's constantly getting fined, which he can't afford to pay, and so he kind of takes off when he sees the police coming, and so do his customers. They all bring their bowls and spoons actually from home because he doesn't have the space to provide them with those. So they bring those from home and they take off whenever they see the police coming. So yeah, it's very common to have a street cart. And I don't know, I think it was inspired for me by on one of my visits to Vietnam, somebody told me that the best pho you could find was on the cart of this very specific man. And we tried to find this man and couldn't, because this guy who told me about him wasn't plugged into that network. And so I was so kind of intrigued by the fact that he made the best pho in Hanoi that I wanted to go home and write his story, which is kind of what happened. I came back to Canada and I just started writing him into being and wondering, well, if he's seen, 87 years of Vietnamese history, he's lived through, what has he been exposed to in his lifetime? And he's the one who kind of led me back through some of the chapters of Vietnamese history.
So back to Pho. Fascinated me when I was reading about you. And there's a couple of articles about you that appeared in one of the papers, or a couple of the papers, I guess, and you were posed in front of a bowl.
Yeah.
How often do you eat it?
Probably once a week, and
yeah.
That probably started when I was an undergraduate. I was an undergraduate at the University of Toronto, and Spadina Avenue is not far away. And it was certainly one of the cheapest and most cheerful bowls of anything you could eat as a student. And so at that point, it was probably twice a week.
Yeah, I mean, I have it maybe once every couple of weeks, maybe once a month.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, I've always liked it. And I've never thought about it until I read, you know, read about the book and read about you.
And how symbolic it is. I mean, it's how much is invested in this bowl. There's such fierce national pride about this soup, which has interesting origins and has become sort of emblematic. It represents the country. It represents the start to every day. It's really a breakfast food in Vietnam. We tend to eat it for lunch or dinner, but you would eat it sort of first thing in the morning before you went to work or school. And you'd probably eat it on the street, on a little plastic chair with a bowl perched on your knees.
Yeah. Is it different in Vietnam than it is in say, Toronto?
The taste of it?
The taste of it.
Well, there tends to be regional variation, and so the northern pho is much more austere in some ways. It's blander. It's they feel it's pure. The North Vietnamese would consider it a much purer bowl. They think that, you know, when people moved south, there was a lot of Chinese influence in the south, and so the taste of the broth has been influenced by Chinese spices. I tend to actually prefer the taste of a southern pho. I think that's maybe my foreign palate. It's not as, the northern pho, again, is not as adorned with green garnish, and, you know, they don't give you hoisin to put in to flavor the meat or the broth. And there are very few northern restaurants in North America because most people who came to North America came from the south. So most of the pho we know is southern pho. But I've sought out quite deliberately the northern restaurants that there are, and there's one a block away from where I live. There's a kind of another mini Chinatown. It's more a Vietnam town at Girard and Broadview in Toronto.
And it's not something that one tries to make at home, right?
Well, I mean, you could, but it would be kind of more of a one-off.
Yeah.
Most people in Vietnam feel like it's way too hot working in a cramped kitchen, and it's way too labor-intensive. You've got to boil that broth for hours, you know, and kind of religiously skim the scum off the surface, you know, that arises from boiling the bones. And it's really labor-intensive, and so why bother? You have these wonderful stalls and shops that are dedicated exclusively to serving you breakfast, and it's really affordable. It's probably about 70 cents a bowl in Vietnam.
Jonathan Kay from the National Post was on this past May. He'd just published a great book called Among the Truthers, a journey into the growing conspiracist underground of 9/11 truthers, birthers, Armageddonites, vaccine hysterics, Hollywood know-nothings, and internet addicts. I asked him about the people featured therein.
We're not supposed to take these people as a whole group because they believe in different things, of course. But can you assign some state diagnosis, I guess, of their state of mind? I mean, for the most part, they're men, right?
Yes. Most conspiracy theorists are men. This is something I immediately noticed when I would go to these conspiracy theory conventions. 9/11 truth conventions, the radical fringes of the Tea Party movement in the United States, and you'd see mostly men, and some of the women who were there looked like they had been sort of dragged there by their boyfriends. And part of it is just many conspiracy theories are extremely detailed, and the people who really get into them will sometimes spend 16 or 18 hours a day in front of a computer, and will become completely antisocial. And will spend all their time watching YouTube videos or performing calculations of how the World Trade Center fell. They'll get extremely interested in science fiction debates about what kind of weapons were used to bring down the World Trade Center, for instance, or what kind of technology was used to alter Barack Obama's birth certificate. They almost regress into a sort of adolescent world of Buck Rogers ray guns and that sort of thing. And it has very, very limited appeal for women. In terms of personality types, I went into the project thinking that there would be a universal personality type for conspiracy theorists. What I found was that the people I interviewed tended to cluster around different kinds of personality types. So sort of a identifiable typology. For instance, younger conspiracy theorists tended to be sort of campus firebrand types, campus revolutionaries, if you will. The sort of people who maybe 20 or 30 years ago would have become Marxists or anarchists and held big noisy demonstrations, but since those ideologies don't hold much currency now, instead they've channeled their political rage into conspiracy theories, and instead they go around downtown with placards that say, you know, tell us the truth about 911 and stuff. And then some of the older conspiracy theorists I interviewed were men who were going through what was essentially a midlife crisis, and they had lost trust in everything in life, public and private, public institutions and private relationships. And the conspiracy theory became a sort of way to express their nihilistic distrust in the society around them. Some of the people I interviewed were genuinely mentally unstable, although that was a very small subset of the people I interviewed. Some of the other people were radicalized nationalists who were using conspiracy theories to recast history according to their chosen ideological script. So you had Islamists or radical Zionists or the like. Birthers also fall into that category, just simply because they are essentially trying to rewrite the 2008 presidential election. I mean, this is, for people who come to conspiracy theories from a political motivation, a lot of it has to do with trying to correct the course of history as they see it, because they think history has taken some illegitimate turn, and they're trying to identify who it was who caused history to go off course.
It's someone like Trump, I guess, right?
Well, Trump is sort of a unique specimen because I don't think he actually ever believed the birther conspiracy theory. I don't see him as a true conspiracy theorist. I think for him it was about marketing. I think he saw that there were millions of Republicans who believed that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States, and most of the mainstream Republican presidential candidates or potential candidates were staying away from that issue because it's so ridiculous. And as a sort of clever marketing campaign, he decided he was going to be the one to sink to that level and exploit it. But I don't think he himself believed it. I think it was just a marketing gimmick.
Yeah, and he's announced this morning that he's not running. It's a big surprise that Donald Trump is an opportunist, I guess.
Yeah.
The famed and prolific novelist Francine Pascal, creator of the huge Sweet Valley High series, had just written a follow-up called Sweet Valley Confidential when I talked to her in April of this year. We talked about the famed series of young adult books and more. You mentioned earlier that Sweet Valley was fantasy, and now bringing Elizabeth to New York City, you described it as the antithesis to Sweet Valley. Is New York, do you think, more real than anywhere else in the world?
It's certainly more real than Sweet Valley, which I made up.
Yeah.
Actually, when I made Sweet Valley up, I always feel that the best part of teenage life is summer, and I wanted a place that was always summer, and so I thought California. However, I had never been there, so I had to create it out of the MGM movies I'd seen,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I came up with Sweet Valley.
Have you been to California since?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and
in fact, 3 years after, 2 years after, I did go out there. And it was exactly as I expected.
Yeah. Back to New York. You've lived there your whole life, have you?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
And I love it, and I do have a home in the south of France that I go to, so I really have the best of both worlds as far as I'm concerned.
What was high school like for you?
Not Sweet Valley High.
Yeah.
It wasn't for anyone, but it was, I did some of the things that Elizabeth does, and did,
yeah.
Which was writing for the school newspaper, and more of me in Elizabeth than in Jessica, but I always feel that Elizabeth and Jessica are sort of Jekyll and Hyde, two sides of one person, and so I can only say that I didn't have that high school experience, and no one else did either.
Graham Kerr, the legendary television host who is best known for The Galloping Gourmet, was on this past spring to promote an appearance at a local event. We had a great chat about his career, food, and more. The Galloping Gourmet was known for generous portions, decadent ingredients, and high fat and cholesterol. Kerr and his wife Trina have since parted ways with their past.
Now, when you look back at your career in television, and you look back at sort of the life that you had, the sort of jet-set life, the hedonism, do you regret that? I mean, your life has changed a great deal.
I've always tried to do what, well, I'm not sure whether I tried, or perhaps it's just my nature, to do the best I can at whatever I'm doing, and to put all my enthusiasm into doing that. I suppose if you start out cooking a crepe Suzette in your father's hotel in England, in Sussex, and you're chatting up the couple who are, you're making the crepe Suzette for, and you're telling them this marvelous story about how it started, whilst folding the little crepe in the orange and lemon and Grand Marnier and Kirsche, and then pushing it out onto the plate, and there you are, madam, there you are. It's that kind of personal enthusiasm and connection to what one is doing. So do I regret it? No, not a bit. Of course, if I look back now and say, was that dangerous? Yes, if you make a habit out of eating that sort of food often, certainly. I really, really, really want to say to people today, I tried to delight. And now I try to delight and do less harm. That's the difference.
One of my favorite guests in the life of this program is the author and former Chatelaine editor Rona Maynard. We talk about a shared passion, books. I just asked her how many she owned.
Let me see. Every time we move, I have to give away a lot of books. And the last time we moved, I gave away 40 to 60 large boxes.
Does that hurt as a book lover to have to give away your books? No?
No. I'll tell you why it doesn't. It's because I always feel that I'm sending my books into the world where they're going to find new readers and affect more people, stimulate more thoughts. After I've read a book, I usually know if it's one that I'm likely to refer back to or want to reread. And there are books that are truly worth rereading because they're just so stupendously good. There are books that reveal other aspects of themselves if you give them a second read. But most books, even most enjoyable books, aren't going to have a second life with one reader. So let them have a second life with another reader, or three more readers.
I'm currently reading an astonishingly good book, Your Voice in My Head. It's a memoir from the writer Emma Forrest, who takes us through her life. On the surface, it's a sort of charmed existence, a talented young writer at 16 with a column in the Sunday Times. She wrote for The Guardian at 21. The same year she published her first novel, Name Dropper. Two more followed, Thin Skin and Cherries in the Snow, plus a life in the glare of pop culture photographers thanks to someone prominent she was dating at the time. But it all unravels as her quirks and eccentricities become damaging to her psyche. She recounts her struggles with cutting and bulimia, the cruel relationship she finds herself in, as well as the effects of such crushing depression. And she's just over 30 years old now. It's wonderfully written, and Emma Forrest joins me now to talk about the book. Worked through in the book is her relationship with her psychiatrist who saved her life. The relationship sort of begins after he dies, and she pieces together who he was, in a way paying tribute to all that he did to save her. EmmaForrest.com is her website. She lives in Los Angeles, where she is a screenwriter. Your Voice in My Head is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plunt Online program, Emma Forrest. Good morning, Ms. Forrest.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, yourself.
Good, thank you for having me.
So, everyone is wondering about a certain acting celebrity
Wow, you got right in there. They usually wait until the end.
Yeah, and I can't promise that I won't ask about Colin Farrell, but early in the book, you go to the movies with Gary Shandling?
Yeah, do you know what? Half my life I've forgotten about. Yeah, I once went to the movies with a friend who brought us their special surprise guest star to the night, Gary Shandling, indeed.
Yeah, now, so your friend knew Gary Shandling,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so, he's such a, I don't know how to, like, I'm a fan of his.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem like a guy that I'd like to hang around with.
Well, I can't really answer that because he clearly didn't want to hang around with me. He ran away.
Yeah. Did you actually go to the movies? Or how? Yeah. But I guess you don't really talk during a movie, right?
No, and also, I mean, I was in such a peculiar place at that time. I don't think I could have really had a especially rational conversation.
Yeah. So when people talk about the book or the press that one reads about the book, invariably the famous name that I've already mentioned comes up. So let's get that out of the way. What in the book is about him?
I've never said it's about Colin Farrell, and I never will. But I know that everyone else will say that. So I just can't. I can't answer that. But the really lovely thing is that I've been getting letters lately from people who say that it's just universal heartbreak, and that, you know, it doesn't matter if it was an actor or a famous person or who it was, they've all had that feeling of just not being able to move past a breakup. So it's been nice for me that while the press is sort of fixated on who that person is, I am getting letters from people who are saying, look, we don't care.
That was from February of this year, the author Emma Forrest on her memoir. From time to time, television personalities appear on the program. Here's the comedian Jessica Holmes, late of her own program on the Comedy Network, The Holmes Show, and CBC's Royal Canadian Air Force. This is from October 2010. You were known for Celine Dion and Liza Minnelli.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing personal appearances and the sort, are you still asked to do those?
Oh, that's the first and foremost thing that people want to see, and I feel like I'm so happy to do it. Now audiences under 30 don't really know who Liza Minnelli is, some of them, and so I find myself not playing her as much for a younger crowd, but people still want me to do Celine all the time, and I feel like she sort of writes the material for me. I just have to repeat what she says verbatim, and then that's comedy somehow. And so if Celine were here right now, she would say, you know, people cannot get enough of me, so I owe it to the world to share my nasal rantings with them. La la,
okay. Is the key to a good impression the sort of heightening some odd idiosyncrasy in the voice or the personality, say?
Yeah, I think I always look for what does this person not really realize about themselves. Like with Celine, Celine Dion has no idea that she comes across as sort of self-centered as she does, because she's this sweetheart and she's totally naive, but at the same time she does believe herself to be, you know, that an angel farted one day and her voice was born of that, and it's her responsibility to save the world with her voice. And with Liza, I think she just doesn't realize how out there she is, so she's just trying to live the way a normal person lives, but she's got these huge ways of seeing the world and reminds everybody never to swallow pills unless you can afford to someone to drive you home and clean up your barf. She's just adorable. I mean, so I'm now with all these new singers being a bit more homogenized and, you know, everybody's got their hair dyed blonde and stuff, it's harder to find people to do impressions of, I find. I'm really pleased with Lady Gaga. I'm trying to work on an impression of her, and it might take me a while to figure out exactly what angle I'll take with her, but I just think she's incredible. I think she's really unique.
And from time to time, television news anchors have appeared. Canada AM's Seamus O'Regan called in from London while covering the royal wedding of William and Catherine for CTV this past spring. On Twitter yesterday, you tweeted a photograph of, I guess, your wardrobe. The suits and the shirts and stuff. Did you have to lug that all the way to London?
I did, and I'm just amazed at my packing abilities, because I'm normally a one knapsack kind of guy and just put everything in.
Yeah.
And now I had to turn over seven, I couldn't believe it, but it's seven outfits, sorry, eight outfits. I had more baggage than Jeannie Becker, which I was a little astounded by. It was very humbling, but there it is.
Yeah, and so do you, what's the outfit on wedding day, on Friday? Is that like tails, or what is that?
Yeah, so Canali's always been my clothing sponsor, and they generously suited me up with a morning suit for the wedding day. So I'm actually in a tails, and tried it on, and it's pretty smashing, I have to say.
Yeah.
Very happy about it.
So what's the feeling like while walking the streets in London? I mean, people are just this is the only thing that's on people's minds, I guess, right?
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of tourists here because the weather's so gorgeous. A lot of tourists here regardless, but they're all on the streets. And where we're located, I mean, where I'm talking to you from right now, just to give you a sense, is right in front of Buckingham Palace. And so this is where all the media is. And, you know, I'm looking right now while I'm talking to you at, three tiers of boxes, a three-level, temporary monstrosity here where you have, all the media of the world, because everyone wants that golden shot of Buckingham Palace in the background. And, there's room where they can put all these media organizations here. So CNN, Anderson Cooper is here, Diane Sawyer is here, Barbara Walters is here. And it's all, and we're up there with them overlooking Buckingham Palace. And we also have some other shots, too. We've got a great shot in front of Westminster Abbey, and we're also going to be at Trafalgar Square, and we're also at two different locations in front of Buckingham Palace. So, the amount of attention that this is getting from around the world is astounding. I mean, I knew that this was going to be a big deal. I knew that a lot of people, particularly in Canada, really see this as a big priority. I did not fully appreciate what a media spectacle it was until I just saw what they had got here. It's like nothing I've seen since the Olympics.
Last fall, Global National got a new anchor in Donna Friesen. She appeared on this program in January to talk about her career and the broadcast. In this clip, we talk about anchors who either stand or sit behind a desk while delivering the news.
Is that something that viewers care about, do you think? I mean,
that's a good question. I don't know.
you do both, right?
I don't know. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's no magic formula to that either. Do viewers care if I'm sitting down for the whole newscast? I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I'm not too bothered about all that. I'm more bothered by or interested in and preoccupied with the quality of the stories we do and the quality of the journalism than whether what I'm wearing or where I'm standing. So I kind of leave that to other people, to the people, the technical people and the director and the, who sort of, that's their expertise. Yeah. I don't know. Do you think it matters? Do you think people care?
You know, I noticed it with you, that you were sitting down, because one of the other national anchors, he stands up through his newscast, and there was a big story a few weeks ago about what happened to his chair.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
And and then I noticed that you do that, I guess, what, halfway through the newscast? Do you stand
up?
Yeah.
We're constantly tweaking it and thinking, does that look good? Does that work? But it is not my major preoccupation, so.
Yeah, for me it doesn't matter, but I just noticed it.
Yeah, interesting.
And I'm sure there are people out there, shut-ins maybe, who probably are concerned about it.
The local anchor scene here in Vancouver is always watched with interest. It's a very competitive market, and in January, CTV BC introduced its new team, Mike Killeen and Tamara Taggart. They joined me 2 weeks after taking over the anchor desk.
The what you're wearing bit. I noticed, because I've been watching over the last couple of weeks, there were a couple of nights there where you'd wear the same color. Was that on purpose?
Are you talking to me? Or
both of you. I guess he was wearing a purple tie and you were wearing a purple...
you want to know honestly how it goes around here?
How does it go?
You want to know what my life is like now? I wake up and I go, I think I'm going to wear this gray jacket and white blouse, and I bring it to work. And then Mike goes, what are you wearing tonight? And I say, I'm going to wear this gray jacket and white blouse. And I can set my watch to it. He walks into the makeup room with his collection of ties, quite cute. And then he holds it up to my jacket, and he goes, "What do you think? Look at this one. Look at it." And I say, "That's the one." And then he puts it on. That's how it goes.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Every afternoon at around 4:30, is it, Mike?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, around 4:30, he comes in with his collection of ties.
So is it a long day for you guys? I mean, does the day end at 7 o'clock when you guys sign off? Or
It is a long day. It's we're part of the morning news meeting at 10:30. And then from there, we make our way into the station. We do that on a conference call. We make our way into the station, grab lunch. So far, out of the 10 days that we've been doing this show, we've had lunch 9 of those days together.
Who pays?
Oh, that depends on a number of circumstances.
We don't need to talk about that. No, but usually we go Dutch, but a couple of times my debit card hasn't worked, so Mike's had to, but I make it up to him. Anyways, we have a 2 o'clock news meeting, and then from there it's just, we hit the ground running, and it's quite hectic right through the show. And then after the show, we usually have a meeting to reflect on how the past hour went, and then we make our way home, and then home life begins, right? For Mike has 2 teenage boys, I have 3 kids under the age of 3 and a half, and it's busy.
In Vancouver, the anchor who's logged more newscasts thus far is the CBC's Tony Parsons. When he was at Global, formerly BCTV, his newscast was at the top of the ratings. Parsons was on the program in November 2009 to talk about his memoir. We discussed his family life, his relationship with his parents, his marriages, and drinking. You talk about your mom in the book, and you describe her as saint-like. She got to see a lot of your success, didn't she?
She did, yeah. She was very proud of my accomplishments. My father, not so much. But Mom always thought that I had done well, and I had picked my job and my vocation properly, and she was proud. She used to write to me and tell me that she sees me on satellite. You know, I was in Toronto. She was living in Sarnia, Ontario, which is, a couple of hundred miles apart, but she used to watch the show, and she would call and say, "Hey, that was a nice tie you wore last night, but you know what, you need a haircut," things like that, like moms do.
Yeah. You mentioned your dad there earlier. You said that when you said he didn't, not so much. Did you mean that he hadn't seen your success, or he wasn't proud of your success?
Well, I know he wasn't outwardly proud. My father was a carpenter and a man of many talents. As a matter of fact, he was good with his hands, and that's how he made his living over the years. And he thought, unless you did something physical, as he did, then you weren't really working. It wasn't a real job. And so he never said to me, you really do a good job as a newscaster. You chose well. He sort of grudgingly admitted toward the end of his life that, yeah, he was proud, but he didn't say anything to me. He said it to his friends, and I got it back from them. And he just thought that, I don't think he really understood what I did and actually made a living from it,
People seem to write memoirs as you said, as an outlet for thinking about themselves and a catharsis. You said you didn't write it in that vein, but you do talk about your father's drinking, and you mentioned that you had a bit of a problem as well. How bad was it for you?
It got to be out of control. I was using a drink for reasons I don't really understand. I had a great job. I had good money coming in, and I also mentioned in the book that I suffered from depression, and I think that got me started. And I went hard at it for a number of years until I finally, either friends or relatives said, "You drink an awful lot, don't you?" And I, of course, you deny it. But after a while, I sat down and thought about it, and yeah, I did drink a lot. I drank hard liquor, and I drank my share. And it never interrupted what I did for a living, but it certainly didn't endear me to a lot of people around me.
Yeah, and now you have it under control?
It's under control. I still drink wine. I like my wine, but that's the only thing I drink now. I mean, not that that's, not liquor in everybody else's estimation, but I don't drink. I can control it. I do.
Yeah. and you also talk about your marriages. You've had more than one. Let's put it that way.
That's kind of you.
Yeah. You're married to Tammy now. You dedicate the book to her.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think you know now that you didn't know before?
I don't know what I know now. I just know that I'm finally with the right person. And, you know, in my business, and this sounds immodest, I think, you sometimes wonder why a person is with you. Is it for the notoriety? Is it for the money? Or is it because they really do love you and want to be with you? So I think there was always a certain doubt in my mind with other people, and that caused a lot of sorrow in my life. I would call myself a cad if I hadn't written that in the book. Then I would now call myself a cad, because I had a way of treating people badly if I had, as my mother would say, gone off them for whatever reason.
You do write that in the book. You call yourself that.
Oh, do I?
Okay. Yeah, you do, yeah. Did you regret not having children?
No. No, I really do admire people, parents, who raise children in this day and age with everything that's around us, you know, the temptations of drugs and other things, and the way the world has gone in terms of war right now and so on and so forth. There's so many things to concern yourself with. Raising kids is, to me, a real challenge, and I'm a little bit too self-centered to have children.
One of the finest and nicest broadcasters in the country is TVO's Steve Paikin. He's moderated the federal leaders' debates 3 times now, and after each debate has called me the next day to talk about the experience. The morning after this past April's debate, he was on the line. Here's the end of that conversation, where we get away from politics and I ask him about a family friend from his past. The other thing I've always wanted to ask you, and I'll end on this, Steve, did you grow up with Martin Short?
Boy, that one's really out of left field, isn't it? Yeah. Well, here's the background on that. Martin Short's dad and my grandfather were in the steel business together in Hamilton. We're both Hamiltonians, and so the Short family and the Paikin family have been friends for, you know, I guess, 70 years, something like that. I mean, it's a long time.
Yeah.
And my dad and my parents and Martin are great, wonderful friends today, as, you know, I believe I am too, and he's had an awful year. His wife passed away this past year, and he was up actually, well, he came up to Canada for a little while. He's got a cottage still in Canada, and he's coming up again this summer, and I expect to see him then. And we talked on the phone, I guess, a few weeks ago as well. And my heart just goes out to him. Martin has had an extraordinary life insofar as he lost both his parents while he was a teenager. He had a brother who predeceased him, an older brother who predeceased him when he was a kid. You know, his wife died in her 50s. And on the other hand, he has lived this, you know, spectacularly successful life where he is brilliant at what he does, has 3 wonderful children. He has, you know, for a guy who's been in show business as long as he had one of those just classically successful, wonderful showbiz marriages that you just can't imagine you're able to have with all of the pressures of a Hollywood life and temptations and so on. But take it from me, they had the real deal. I mean, anybody who could have had that kind of marriage would want that kind of marriage. Martin and Nancy were just so wonderful together. And, you know, I guess he's 10 years older than me, so he just turned 61. I'm going to turn 51 in a couple of months. And, you know, like, I just don't know how he does it. He still performs. He still, he goes on talk shows. He's still funny. And he's just, I'm in tears when I think about what the guy's been through and how he manages to just get up in the morning. He's a hero of mine. He just does it.
He's such a brilliant comic, and
totally.
And I brought that up because I remember an interview you did with him a couple of years ago, and it made me wonder how well you knew one another.
Well, I've known him since I was a little kid, I have such admiration for the guy because talk about the highest highs and the lowest lows that he's experienced in life, and somehow he has, and you know, it comes through every time we are in each other's company or we talk. He's just got such wonderful perspective on life. He gets it. And, you know, it's funny, Joseph, I'm sitting here in my office as I talk to you, and on my wall in front of me, among all the pictures I have and the political buttons and, you know, all of this, I have here a chart, which I always keep in front of me, and I look at almost every day, and it's called Martin Short's Secrets to a Good Life.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's basically nine things. How am I? How are my wife and kids? How's my extended family? How are my friends? Am I financially okay? How's my career? How's my creativity? How's my discipline? How's my lifestyle? And this man, despite the high highs and the low lows he's had in his life, has somehow been able to look at those nine secrets to a good life and keep them, you know, close to his heart. And I think it's brilliant advice for, you know, not getting too up when things go well and not getting too down when things go badly and just keeping it all in perspective. He's a great, I'm actually thrilled that you asked me about him because he's just one of the truly great, great people I've had a chance to know and learn from, I hope people who listen to this just appreciate what a magnificent guy he really is.
Yeah, he just seems like it, and you know, and I'm kind of glad that I know that now about him. I mean, I just know him from when he goes on Letterman, and he's hilarious on Letterman.
He is, isn't
yeah.
he?
It sounds as though I'm sucking up, Steve, but I don't care. You did such a great job last night, and I remain a big fan.
You're very kind, and once again, thank you for calling, and I actually do look forward to, you won't believe this, but actually, as soon as the debate was over last night, I thought to myself, I wonder what Joe's going to ask me tomorrow, because this is a bit of a tradition for us, and it's a bit of a debrief, you know, it's a chance for me to kind of debrief on how things went, and even though you get a lot of tweets and a lot of emails, I can't really get enough feedback on how things went, the format, how the leaders did, who won. You know, whether I cocked it up, I do want to know all this, and you're a very sensible sounding board for all this stuff, so I appreciate our conversations as well.
Thank you very much, Steve.
All the best, Joe.
On to one of the interests I keep amused on this program, that of Philippine politics and culture. I took an interest in it, not the least from my roots, as my parents are Filipino, but certainly more so after a vacation there a couple of years ago. In the midst of presidential elections in the spring of 2010, I had on one of the Philippines' prominent commentators, a former cabinet secretary, Winnie Monsod. In the Philippines, have you always elected your president and vice president separately, or was that since 1987?
Just a minute. I want to check that.
Sure.
Hi. Yeah, I'm sorry. We had to stop, but I had to check with my... with my husband.
Sure.
Sorry about that. Because I can't remember that the vice president and the president were had to be together. You voted for the president and you voted for the vice president. And if they didn't happen to be with the same party, well, then that's the people's will.
Yeah, and does that...
Besides which, it didn't really matter because the parties were not ideologically different one from the other.
Your husband helped draft the Constitution, right?
Yes. And I'm talking about the previous constitutions,
right.
I cannot remember I think it may have started with Quezon, with Senator President Quezon, when he didn't want us to follow the United States in that particular provision that the president and vice president have to belong to the same party. Mainly because, as I said, the difference in parties in the ideologies of the parties were not significant.
And
in fact, there are no ideologies.
Here's the novelist Miguel Sahuco, author of Ilustrado from May 2010, talking about Philippine culture.
And they found that going through this book, you know, it forced them to look back on not just what was presented in the book, but also, you know, I guess the book in a way outlined their past life in very broad strokes, and it led them also to look back and undergo some sort of introspection, which is great, because this is also something that I want other readers, not just within the family, but within the Filipino diaspora, within culture, to also undergo this introspection and looking back at, you know, where we've come from and who we are and where we're going. The book is, in one sense, historical fiction. It charts 150 years of Philippine history. So it's in that way, it should hopefully lead Filipinos to look back a little bit more, but also hopefully let the rest of the world read the book, understand, you know, the difficulties and the issues that we Filipinos have gone through, and understand why. All too often people look at the Philippines and they say, well, you know, it's a place of corruption and unrest. There's Imelda Marcos, and there's domestic helpers, and there's the guy who shot Versace. You know, it's a very limited view of who Filipinos are. And I'm hoping that my book, along with all the other great works coming from Filipino writers everywhere, can slowly change this view and complicate things and make things a little bit more nuanced and, well, you know, more real in terms of how people perceive us.
Now, that's the thing that I was struck most about while reading this book. I also, while reading the book, saw that Brillante Mendoza film, Lola.
Mm-hmm.
And in seeing that, reading this book, I was struck at the vastness of Filipino culture, that it's not just Wow Wow We or Dolphy.
That's right.
You know? And I think you mentioned Maids Marcos. People think of the Philippines of that. They also think of Manny Pacquiao, I guess. That's what you wanted readers within the Philippines, as well as without, to come away after reading this book, right? That it was more than that.
Yeah, we're all of those things, and we're proudly all of those things, but we're so much more.
Well, why do you think people see the Philippines like that, though?
I think partly because we're underrepresented within the arts. I mean, you know, movies and television and radio and books, these are stories of ourselves and stories of cultures. But, you know, we Filipinos, unlike all the other Asian American or Asian Canadian type of communities, we're so good at, we're such great chameleons. We're so good at joining a new culture, probably because of our experience, you know, as an American colony, that all too often, you know, we're no longer defined as that community, but, you know, only defined in broader terms because we assimilate so well. And I think it's important for the Filipinos especially to really keep at, you know, writing their books and telling their stories and making their films so that people can understand, you know, how complicated and nuanced and very special we are.
The cultural advocate Carlos Celdran was in Vancouver in June, and I talked to him about his country and how the Philippines is perceived.
Believe it or not, quite a great number of people come to my tours are local Filipinos who live within the city itself. We who live in Manila are actually kind of ignorant of the history of our own city. And so a lot of people come to tours to sort of like fill in the gaps. Because it's a very misunderstood city. A lot of people think that Manila is this gritty, hideous place. But, you know, once you look through all the grime and once you look through all of the bad elements, they do some sort of visual archaeology, so to speak. You're going to find a city that's really rich in history and beauty and poetry. I really believe if you can't find beauty and poetry in Manila, you can never find beauty and poetry anywhere.
You mentioned that people think of Manila as this gritty, hideous place. Who's responsible for that sort of perception of it?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the decentralization of management when it comes to controlling the city of Manila. Once upon a time, in the 1970s, Imelda Romualdez Marcos was the governor of all of Manila. So pretty much it was underneath one hand, so power was much more centralized and things got done faster, and there was an overall vision for the city. But once Imelda left and Cory Aquino came in and everything devolved, the position that was once held by Mrs. Marcos is now being held by other people who don't hold that much power. So pretty much now Manila has become a city of 12 different little cities run by 12 different mayors who have 12 different systems of getting things done. So hence, you get all the disorganization. But the way Manila really got to be where it is today, which is kind of, as I said, misunderstood and gritty, had a lot to do with World War II. When the Americans came in 1945 and blasted our city off the face of the earth, pretty much the city never recovered.
And so sort of the misunderstanding that say, people in this country have about the Philippines.
They think Manila got ugly on its own. Trust me, no, we had a lot of international help.
Yeah, and so when you tell people this, and I understand in your tours that you talk about this, do you think you change people's minds?
Some of them, I manage to change their minds. A lot of them, some of them get offended, especially when I talk about the General Douglas MacArthur's role in the destruction of our city. Because a lot of people think that the Japanese destroyed Manila, but the Japanese were only in charge of massacring everybody. It was the American forces who completely obliterated the city through artillery fire. So it is kind of ever since World War II, the city has never really been able to pick itself up and retain the urban fabric that we had before 1945. And so, you know, a lot of Americans come along with a kind of disillusion that all of a sudden we're not viewing General Douglas MacArthur as the hero that he's supposed to be.
Well, we're talking on the weekend of June the 12th. Do you think about what being Filipino means to you around this time of year? I mean, I guess you do it year-round.
Yeah, actually, worrying about Filipino identity is something that we don't worry much about back home, because every day we're just so busy being Filipino that we never need or find the time to reflect upon or to gaze at our navel, so to speak. But June 12th is I don't know. There's many days for when you consider independence. Is it really June 12th? Is it really July 4? I mean, if you really come to think about it, well, this is just on a personal level. When the Philippines only really ran itself without any imperialist forces pulling the strings behind the curtain, so to speak, was really only in 1991 or 92 when we kicked out the U.S. bases. So I personally really believe our Independence Day is somewhere in November of 1991 and not in June 12, 1898.
But to naval gaze for just a sec here, because you're in Vancouver to sort of talk about being Filipino. Yeah, and talk about Filipino culture. It's impossible to define a people, to define a culture, but, I mean, do you try at all?
I just try to tell people not to worry about it so much, because the Philippines is really one of the first postmodern cultures, so to speak. Our culture has been infected by foreign cultures way ahead of a lot of people back in the region where we're in, especially such disparate cultures like the United States and Spain, which is completely out of its context when it comes to Asia. So I think the Philippines is really one of the first countries to go down the road where the rest of the world is going now. I mean, right now the world's getting so globalized, and cultures, the defining lines between cultures are getting thinner and thinner and thinner. That happened to us back in 1898. Hell, that happened back to us in 1521.
San Francisco Chronicle editor-at-large Phil Bronstein was a foreign correspondent of the 1980s covering the Philippines. He was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, as a matter of fact, while his colleague, the photographer Kim Kamenich, won. Here he is talking about the end of the Marcos regime, 25 years after the fact.
The first trip I went, Kim was not with me, and I specifically asked the second time if he could go, because he's such a great photographer. And I think there may have been one other time I went without him in that five-year period, or four-year period. I'm trying to think. I can't remember, but for the most part, we went together.
So what were the days like? Would you guys be together? Like, you'd be out reporting, and then he'd just tag along, I guess, taking photographs, right?
Well, we would go some places where we knew there were things happening or might be things happening or for specific interviews. But we also operated very well independently. You know, he would go out and look for things that would make great pictures, and I would go out and look for things that would make great stories. And if one of us had to then double back, which happened a fair amount, and we did. What we tried to do was not, you know, we didn't spend any time in the hotel pool, which is kind of the not unrealistic stereotype of a lot of bad foreign correspondents.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you were in the palace, I guess, after the Marcoses left, right?
Yes.
This is before all the people came in, right? Before.
Yes, we sort of. There was a very ugly line of kids who had been handed weapons after Marcos had left to try and stave off people. And it was pretty violent and ugly. And Kim was not with me at that point. He was still trying to send photos very archaically, which, you know, back in those days, you had to put them on a drum and it took forever to read. But so I went, I'd heard, someone had called me to tell me that the helicopters were taking off. So I went over there, I got past this group of kids, got into the palace. There were a few guards there who were sort of terrified, didn't know what was going on. I talked my way past them and got into the private quarters and went through the private quarters of the Marcoses.
And what was that like? What did you see?
Well, it was, you know, pretty amazing. It was clearly a hasty exit. You know, drawers were pulled out from dressers and clothes and other items were strewn around. I, of course, looked through. At some point, Mark Feynman, who was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times in the Philippines, joined me. He got in, too, and the two of us, and I think Lynn Newman, who was a freelancer, I think the three of us were in there alone, and we were looking through documents and found some interesting documents, and saw in, we walked right past the vault where Imelda had apparently had her, you know, had her tools. She'd taken a lot, but apparently, based on what some of Cory Aquino's yellow ladies were wearing the next morning on TV, apparently she left some of them. So we didn't see those. There was a sort of a makeshift hospital operation there, clearly to tend to Marcos. It was just mostly the ambiance of this place that had held really all the power from where the power emanated for so many years, and it was just like a hurricane had gone through it, and they clearly did not have a lot of time to pack up.
And so after the Marcoses leave and Aquino becomes president, was your sense that democracy came to the Philippines? Do you think that they were well served afterwards?
Well, I think it was a political revolution, strictly. It was not a social or cultural revolution. I think, you know, you still have 70% of the population under the poverty level. You still have great disparity between haves and have-nots. You know, you've had several presidents who've been accused of great corruption. One of them went to jail, Estrada, since then. You know, you don't have an endless array of military coups, which you had for a while. You know, you have elections. I'm not sure how clean they are. I think, you know, corruption continues to be a huge problem. So I think that Cory Aquino was a pivotal figure in history. She was the right person at the right time to replace Marcos and to be the symbol of all of the frustrations of the many years of martial law. But I think ultimately she did not. And maybe wasn't capable of changing much. And then after Cory, you know, I think it was a series. It's been a series, and I don't know about Noynoy Aquino. I don't know him. I met him as a young man, very young man. Supposedly he's intent on rooting out corruption, but I think that the fundamental problems of the society remained after people power.
I'm wondering what can the Tunisians and the Egyptians and perhaps the Libyans learn from all this?
Well, I think that People Power in the Philippines was really the first contemporary moment where people rose up and in a relatively bloodless manner got rid of a dictator. And I think that people were inspired in a lot of places. People were inspired in Burma. People were inspired in South Korea. People were inspired ultimately in Eastern Europe. So I think that it did have at that time a ripple effect throughout the world. In some of those cases, you know, the uprisings were successful in changing things. In some cases, they were notoriously not successful. And it's been 25 years, so I'm not sure that people, I mean, most of the people probably in Tahrir Square or in any of these other countries, whether it's Tunisia or
or Libya, I don't think, I suspect most of the people out in the streets weren't even born in 1986. So I'm not sure that there's, you know, they owe anything to, there's a legacy. But I think the fact that it was the first time that it happened and that it was successful probably historically created some space for this kind of thing. And we still don't know how it's going to come out.
HBO made a documentary on all this some years later, A Dangerous Life. Was the Gary Busey part based on you?
Well, the guy who did most of the screenwriting worked with me. This guy, Lynn Newman.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of moments, like Kim and I were the only ones with this guy, this wonderful, brilliant guy, Emilio Javier, Harvard-educated, young politician, huge promise, was on the Aquino side, and we spent election day with him, and then he was killed a few days later when the votes were being counted, and we'd interviewed the sort of the Marcos warlord there, who clearly was had some responsibility. And then we flew back with his brother, who had gone down there to claim the body. So there were scenes in that movie that only could have been based on our experiences because no one else was down there.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can tell you. Otherwise, I have no idea.
An indulgence talked about on this program is my experiment with fountain pens. I asked the author Thomas Trofimuk about them in this interview from September 2009.
Now, I read online about the fountain pens. You write the first draft in ink, do you?
Yep.
I was fascinated by the fountain pens. Are they the ones with the funny tips at the end?
Yeah, and you know what? I've been given fountain pens that are I think are quite expensive. And they're the ones that I seem to lose. And I have a couple of the bottom line Waterman fountain pens. I think they're $35, and I can't seem to lose them. I actually tried to lose them. I left them in a restaurant after signing the bill, and walked a block down away, and the waiter has chased me with this little cheap pen. So, but it's. For me, it slows down the velocity of the writing, and it's just it just really works for me to put that first draft on paper, that tactile experience of pen on paper. And it could be a pencil, it could be anything. I just prefer fountain pens. That's just me. I'm not a Luddite. I just like fountain pens.
Yeah, I use Parker pens.
Oh,
The rollerball ones, not the actual fountain pens.
And Parker makes a wonderful fountain pen too.
Yeah, so, I was thinking of using a fountain pen or going to fountain pens. Yep. So, do you recommend it?
I love it. Yeah, I would recommend it actually. They used to be messy affairs, and they've got these little cartridges now, and they've got these little sucker up things that suck up the ink. And they just work for me now. So yeah. I should try it.
Yeah.
Unless you're left-handed. Left-handed people have problems with
you smear the ink, right?
Yeah.
The author and critic, Robert J. Wiersma, was on not long after and takes the obsession further.
I had Thomas Trofimuk on a few weeks ago.
Yep.
When he was in town for his book. And I read in the notes that he writes with a fountain pen. And so this began the last 6 weeks or so, this journey from the beginning of a relationship between me and a fountain pen. I went out and bought a cross pen, and then you and I had a discussion on this on Facebook.
Yeah, I revealed my full fountain pen wankery in that post.
Yeah, well, I found it highly instructive. And then about a week after, it's a cross pen, and I don't know, it's made out of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke. The thing got screwed on, and I couldn't unscrew it and change the ink, etc. So I sent it in with a $6 check to the cross pen people, and I've been waiting. I think about 5 or 6 weeks, and it just came this morning. So I've got my notes in front of me, and I'm making notes with my pen.
Uh-huh.
What kind of pen do you use?
I'm all over the map. Currently, I'm carrying a Lamy fountain pen and a Pelican. So two good German fountain pens.
Yeah, and why for you fountain pens as opposed to like a ballpoint? I'm a big fan of rollerballs, and I use the Parker rollerballs.
I've played with rollerballs. Part of it's just affectation, of course.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody picks up a a fountain pen without thinking, oh, this is cool.
Right, right.
But I like the way they feel in my hand. I like the way the words come out. I adore the process of writing. And one of the things that I like about it is just how sensual it is. Like the feeling of actually putting ink down on paper. The way a good nib would just skate over the surface of the paper and leave behind the traces of the words. It's a beautiful thing to me.
And have you tried writing with, say, a pencil or something else other than a fountain pen?
I've used rollerballs. I've used gel pens. And I've used the sort of fiber art pens. Those are quite fun. But I think I like them because they're the closest you get to a fountain pen without being a fountain pen.
And earlier this year, I managed to work talk of fountain pens with Senator Hugh Siegel.
In the acknowledgments in the book, you say that you use a fountain pen, and I've just started using a fountain pen myself. I'm wondering what kind you use.
Great question. I use a Schaefer. I've used a Schaefer for a very long time, and it's a great pen, and I've always written all my, this I guess is my fifth book, on fountain pen and yellow foolscap, and I have people who help me type it who've never forgiven me for that, but I've hung in there nonetheless.
I use a cross, and I'm enjoying it. And
good.
So, yeah.
Well, it's one of the great joys in life, and, you know, I think the words flow on occasion when the ink flows, and I'm not sure that the digital process is quite as ennobling in that way.
Yeah.
To end the program, a story from the inimitable Mike McArdle. He's the magnificent storyteller whose pieces have appeared at the end of the Global BC NewsHour. He's written a number of books, and over the last 4 years around Christmas, he comes on to share more stories. Since he's at the end of the NewsHour, why not have him at the end of this program now? Here's Mike McArdle from December 2008 talking about Harold.
Well, there's a fellow in the book who contacted you. He wanted your permission because he bought your previous books and he wanted to record some of the stories in there for a friend who was blind.
Oh, that's Harold.
Harold.
Harold is
Harold. Harold is Harold.
Harold is 90 now. He was 89 when I first met him. And he said that his story is so great. I've done a story about him now in addition to the story in the book, but he said that he got out of the Air Force after the war, and he really wanted to be a dentist, but he didn't have any money. And he had gotten, oh my God, what was it, $1,500 or $2,000 in back pay from the Canadian government, and that was not nearly enough money to go to dental school, which he had to go all the way to Alberta to do. And so his older brother said, well, why don't, they're living in Vancouver, this is the late sort of 46 or 47, and the city's growing pretty rapidly. He says, so the brother says, why don't we build a house? And we'll use your money, build a house, sell the house, and use your the profits, and you can start in dental school. And so this guy, Harold, says, the younger brother says, that's a great idea. I like that, except how do you build a house? I mean, like, neither of them had ever built even a birdhouse. So the older brother has this other friend who just got out of the army, and the older friend builds houses for a living. He built it before and after the war. So they went over to this guy's house, and they knocked on his door, and his name is Frank, and he says, Frank, would you tell us how to build a house? So they go in, they have coffee and sandwiches at his kitchen table, and Frank tells Harold and his brother, how to lay a foundation. They get up in the morning, they bought this little lot somewhere in South Vancouver with rubble and blackberries in it. They clear it out. They start laying the foundation. The next night they go back and they ask, Frank, what do we do now? And he says something about putting in some walls or whatever it was, some framing. And every night for 4 months or so, they keep going back, have coffee. They don't go to school. Building school. They don't have they have no training. He tells them what tools to get or to borrow. And presto, the house is built. 4 months later, they sold it for $4,000. He took the $2,000 and started dental school. They built a couple of more houses over the years. And years and years and years pass. Okay, the older brother dies. Harold says he wants to do stories for this blind friend of his, and he wants to come to my house and pick up something. So I go outside, and I know this guy's about by then 90, and I figure he's going to be driving a Pontiac or an Oldsmobile or something like that down the street. I'm surprised he's still driving, and I'm waiting for him, and I see this biker coming down the street. I think, oh my Lord, please don't scare the guy named Harold. He's going to be coming up in his old car. Well, the biker's coming closer and closer and pulls up and stops right in front of me. And he gets off his motorcycle, takes off his helmet. That's Harold. He said, you can't be riding a motorcycle when you're 90. And he says, well, why not?
Yeah.
Just, why can't you, can't build a house? Why can't I build a house? You can't go to dental school. Why can't I go to dental school? Takes off his gloves and he says, you know, they're gardening gloves. I can't afford the, regular, leather motorcycle gloves. Anyhow, so I give him this stuff, these stories, and, he heads off to see, his friend, who's blind, who, of course, by now you figured out, his blind friend is Frank, who told him how to build a house. So, 60 years ago, Harold sat at a kitchen table listening to Frank teach him how to build a house. Now, Harold goes and sits at the same kitchen table and tells Frank stories of his adventures in the war and stories from my books and other books, too, about to keep him entertained because old Frank can't read or can't see anymore. And I'm hearing that story, and I'm thinking, oh, God, you, Harold, are so nice.
Yeah.
And you, Frank, you taught, before BCIT, sitting at a table, you told the guy how to build a house, and he built the house. And we went back, and we saw it, and the house is still there.
Really?
It's a, it's a small bungalow kind of thing in Ontario on 45th or something, or around that area. A guy comes out of the house, and I say, this guy built it, and he's amazed. Just, wow. You mean I can touch the real person who actually built the house? And he didn't have blueprints. He just did it with a tape measure and a hammer. Wow. That's fantastic people who built this country.
Last December, when Mike was on to talk about his last book, I asked him about Harold, and he said he wasn't riding the motorcycle anymore, but he was due to have dinner at the McCardle House at Christmas. Mike's got a book coming out again this fall, I think his seventh, and I hope he'll be on again. I'll end this program, as I did last year, acknowledging the people who've helped over the years. Sure, I produce a program, do the research, book the guests, and conduct the interviews, but there are others who help along the way. The guests themselves make the program more than a one-sided monologue on the internet. There are a number of publicists who make sure certain guests are on my radar, as well as ones who I approach when I want to talk to someone in particular. There are my friends and family who encourage this endeavor, and there's the audience who listens. To all of them, my appreciation and thanks. On to year 8. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.